Cosmic Shed.
You're listening to The Cosmic Shed, a show that explores the way science and storytelling collide.
We'll be talking about films, books, music, theatre, TV, and anything else that catches our curiosity. From rigorously accurate science fact to ridiculously speculative science fiction.
We don't want to nitpick, but to celebrate the ways science and art can complement and enrich each other.
Mostly, we just want to talk about nerdy things that make us happy.
We've decided to do all of this from a crumbling garden shed somewhere in suburban Bristol.
The Cosmic Shed.
Science fact.
Science fiction.
And everything in between. Hello, and welcome to the 9th episode of The Cosmic Shed. I'm Andrew, and with me today are...
Laura.
And...
Ben.
Today's episode is all about Jurassic World and Park. We'll be talking about the films, the science of the fictional world, the science of the real world of dinosaurs, and we'll be hearing from
Phil Manning,
Professor of Natural History at the University of Manchester,
Beth Shapiro,
who is an Associate Professor of Evolutionary Molecular Biology at the University of California.
Jim Al-Khalili.
Professor of Physics at the University of Surrey, theoretical physicist, author and broadcaster. And if you're patient, you might hear something from Andy Day. So, Jurassic World.
Was directed by...
Colin Trevorrow.
Written by...
Loads of people.
Music by...
Michael Giacchino.
The cast...
Chris Pratt...
As Owen.
Bryce Dallas Howard...
As Claire...
Omar Sy...
As Barry.
Irfan Khan.
As Simon Mizrani.
B.D. Wong.
As Dr. Henry Wu.
Ty Simpkins and Nick Robinson as the kids.
Ben?
Yeah?
Have you done a poem?
For this episode, Andrew first kind of suggested some kind of genetic mashup of poetry styles to go with the one of the themes of the film. So I was thinking maybe, you know, a limerick cross with haiku with maybe a little bit of epic poem in there. That was far too difficult.
Bottled it again.
Yeah, far too difficult for my
the shed down.
Reptile brain to handle. So I went back to Andrew and said, I just can't do it. Give me another idea. And he suggested another really important part of Jurassic World is referencing Jurassic Park. And that kind of endless sort of cycle, referencing itself, referencing the fact they've got product placement, but there's also loads of referencing that it's a sequel, and the sequels are kind of pointless. There's a lot of referencing in this film. So I found a poetry form called The Golden Shovel. It was created by a poet called Terence Hayes. The idea of this poem is you take a line, or a long chunk, could be any length, from a poem that you admire. He, when he first invented this form, took most of a poem called We Real Cool by Gwendolyn Brooks, and you take it one word at a time and you put each word at the end of your lines. So, for example, if the line you choose is six words long, you'll end up with a poem that is six lines long,
okay,
with one of those words at the end of each line. So what I did, rather than go back to a poem, I chose a line of dialogue from Jurassic Park.
Okay.
And have made a poem using the words from that line of dialogue. Thinking of you today as I stood, waiting for my turn on the ride around the park, with your old backpack on my shoulders, I thought about your distrust of this place and the geniuses who decided to finally accomplish what you came to see as something foolish, hubristic, as the dream of a man running out of time fast. Well, I think if you could see it as I do today, you would flee as quickly as you could.
Thanks, Ben.
Thanks.
So, mini competition, mini poem-based competition. As I said, that was a Golden Shovel poem, and I used a line of dialogue from Jurassic Park. So the question to win a prize, which Andrew will tell us about in a minute, is what was the line of dialogue that I chose and which character said it?
The prize is a diamond light source T-shirt. Diamond Light Source is a particle accelerator which kind of works like a giant microscope, and Phil Manning uses it to study dinosaur bones. Lauren's question, which she posted on our Facebook group, was, what could mechanical engineers take from paleontology to apply to robotics?
Part of the team at the University of Manchester, including Phil Sellers, who's in the Faculty of Life Sciences, and myself and a number of other people, have been using a technique which is basically using a genetic algorithm. And it's a field where you use evolution in robotics basically to search for the most effective muscle activation patterns to give the optimized mobilization of a skeletal system, whether it be a human, horse, or dinosaur. And so we're trying to understand gait generation and maximum running speeds in dinosaurs by studying living animals, so we can then apply the same models to the extinct ones. So we're already interested in evolutionary robotics. Now, the systems which they're using on these remarkable robots, the company's called Boston Dynamics. And Boston Dynamics is an offshoot from MIT, this amazing Massachusetts Institute of Technology, which is the top school to go and do this kind of stuff in the US. And they have developed robots which are blisteringly brilliant. And I just got to persuade them to create a dinosaur. Because they're so up there with the mammals. They have got something that looks like a horse, something that looks like a cat, something even looks like a dog. In fact, they even named it Big Dog. I want to see Big T. I want to see Mr. T Rex running around the place at Boston Dynamics. Who knows? Because dinosaurs are around for, 175 million years. Remarkably successful. Us mammals, mere blip on the horizon. We've only just really started to sort of find our ecological space, shall we say. Dinosaurs were around for long enough, maybe they hit upon amazing adaptations that we have yet to optimize in our own 21st century world, but the Boston Dynamic people are in the perfect position to do so.
Thanks very much to Lauren for the question, and thanks to Phil for answering it. You could hear in the background there, or maybe not even in the background, in the foreground, a clicking noise. That clicking noise was cosmic rays.
What?
I know. I walked over to a chamber where the clicking noise was coming from, and I spoke to somebody called Catherine Boast from Oxford University.
This is a spark chamber, and it effectively shows us cosmic rays. Cosmic rays are particles, high energy particles, coming down from space, and they're everywhere all the time. This device allows us to visualise them, to see them. So high-energy particles come in and interact with the Earth's atmosphere, and that produces a shower of particles, so a lot of particles from this one interaction. Now, a lot of those don't get as far as Earth, but muons, a particular kind, do. They don't interact very often, but we can hear how often they do interact with a volume of that kind of size. They interact with anything. So the spark chamber is set up so that we have a flash of light and the sparking sound every time one of these interactions happens.
Wow. Oh, cosmic cool. Rays in Cheltenham.
Who knew? Imagine that.
Some in the shed. No. But back to Jurassic World. Ben and I watched Jurassic Park again over the weekend.
Yeah.
And I'd forgotten an awful lot about the film.
I don't know if I've retconned this memory, but I have a possibly false memory of sitting in a really boring English literature class and kind of sneaking Jurassic Park under the table because I was so into it. I mean, Michael Crichton's books you can read in a day, and they're that pacey, and they're ridiculous. But at the time, I was just so into the ideas in the book and the kind of brilliant way it's constructed. The film is a fantastic adaptation of the book, and it's the pinnacle. We talked a little bit about this with Apollo 13, that era when CGI was coming in and starting to be used much more, but also you had brilliant animatronics, debates about the science, the ethics, Jeff Goldblum at his sexy, sleaziest best. Really well cast. The characters aren't necessarily the deepest bunch in the world, but they're aspirational, they're scientists, they're smart people who are just doing their best in this situation. It was trendy science at the time, talking about chaos theory, but it's really nice that sort of structure, that it's not just one thing that goes wrong on the island, but it's a whole bunch of things. It's not just the rival company trying to steal the embryos. It's not just that there's a big storm coming. It's not just that John Hammond's grandkids are arriving at the island. It's not just that the velociraptors are much smarter than anyone anticipated. All of those things kind of knit together to make the whole system unstable and unpredictable in the manner of, that chaos theory predicts.
It's funny you should talk about chaos theory, Ben. Because when I was at Cheltenham Science Festival, I had an opportunity to speak to Jim Al-Khalili. So I asked him what chaos theory is all about.
It's a subject that's relatively new in as much as it really kicked off in the middle of the 20th century. There was an American meteorologist called Edward Lorenz who was studying weather and the unpredictability of weather. And you know, we all understand now that you know, we might be able to predict if it's going to rain tomorrow, but there's no way that we can predict if it's going to rain on this date next year, say, or 10 years from now. Lorenz was the person who coined the term the butterfly effect. So his idea was that if you want to know how a system will evolve in the future, you have to know everything about it now. So if you know where all the particles in a box are and how fast they're moving and in what direction, and then you could, and you understood the forces between them, you could use a powerful computer to calculate how they will behave in the future. But the further into the future you want to be able to predict, the more you need to know about them now. So the butterfly effect, which led to the whole idea of chaos theory, is that a butterfly flapping its wings on one side of the world could ultimately lead to a storm on the other side of the world. And it's not one particular butterfly, of course, but you know, tiny changes in the initial conditions will magnify over time such that you can never predict the future. So for me, I mean, there are other aspects of how to define chaos theory, how something looks like it's behaving completely randomly. But for me, chaos theory is all about our inability, even in a universe where everything is determined, cause and effect, what we call a deterministic universe. Chaos theory says we can never predict the future. We can get better. We can maybe predict if it's going to rain next week or even in 2 weeks' time with better computers. But we can never work out our future indefinitely into the future thanks to chaos theory.
Jim Al-Khalili, if you don't know his television programmes, do seek them out. He does a lot of things for BBC. He's got an incredible ability to make very complex science very, very accessible. The more complicated it is, the more I want Jim Al-Khalili to talk about it.
So more science. Let's talk about more science.
Okay. We haven't talked about Jurassic World at
all. Oh, Cretaceous World.
Is that what it should be called?
Not necessarily Jurassic World should be called Cretaceous World, but Jurassic Park certainly should be called Cretaceous Park. The dinosaurs in Jurassic Park were actually from the Cretaceous period. But Jurassic has a better ring to it.
Doesn't sound as cool.
Doesn't sound as cool.
What dinosaurs would they have had in Jurassic Park?
You'd have more herbivores. Less exciting, less destruction. You'd see a lot of trees being felled.
So no T-Rex, no raptors.
No raptors, nothing like that. You're looking at more sauropods.
Sounds good. I hope that's going to be the sequel.
Yeah, it sounds peaceful.
Peaceful, yeah.
Right, so Jurassic World. Let's actually talk about the film. In fairness to any film that's going to come out after Jurassic Park, it felt like when Jurassic Park came out, there was this magical thing going on. The dinosaurs looked real for the first time in film. You could never, with anything else now, you can't recapture the excitement that there was at that time. And so any film is going to lack something in comparison to Jurassic Park. It also feels like they've sat down and gone, we can't create the magic the way it was created in Jurassic Park, so let's do lots of references. And it feels a bit like a theme park ride in itself. It's kind of those moments, those references, you kind of expect people in the audience, if we were in a different country where people behave like that, to go yay every time there's a reference. There's a part of me that's enjoying that and having this fun, and it was a really fun Friday night. The cinema was packed. It was a fun experience, and it was utterly ridiculous. That I found the film utterly ridiculous, but I thoroughly enjoyed my time in the cinema watching it.
It didn't disappoint in the fact that you go to the cinema to see dinosaurs on the screen, and there are dinosaurs on the screen. Great. Although I think I would have rather have seen walking with dinosaurs on a larger screen.
This is more running in high heels with dinosaurs.
It feels like something that you have waited 20 years to see. You know exactly what you're going to get. It is quite comforting, the fact that that's something that I've grown up with, that I've recognised in Jurassic Park and then through to Jurassic World. And it's quite nice to go and revisit your childhood in the cinema.
Actually seeing this park kind of realised the bits of the visitor centre that you see are great and clever, moments with the hologram. It feels a bit too real in some ways, that it's so crowded and corporatized as Starbucks.
I liked the holograms a lot. I thought they were great.
Yeah.
I'd rush to the island just to see the holograms.
And to see Mr. DNA back.
Yeah, yeah. The other thing that I kind of enjoyed at the start was when they go through the gates and you get this sense of how small that was.
There's a lot of commentary on the film as a film and the film as a sequel and referencing back. There's lots of that. Some of that is quite cleverly done. There's some nice gags. Jake Johnson's character with the original Jurassic Park t-shirt and most of the things involving that control room were quite nicely done. Some really interesting actors. Lots of TV actors. Jake Johnson, obviously, from New Girl. Judy Greer from Arrested Development is in there for 2 seconds. Vincent D'Onofrio, who is the Kingpin in the recent Daredevil series on Netflix. Lauren Lapkus from Orange is the New Black. That's so lots of really interesting faces in there.
Chris Pratt. I think his personality, the humour shines through. Although the role that he was given didn't have an awful lot of personality to it.
Without Chris Pratt, there would be a massive hole in this film.
It was nothing.
I don't think he quite sells it, but he almost sells the raptor training sequences, the raptor whispering scenes, almost. Like, he's really committed to it. He's really intense within that role. And you're almost distracted enough to forget how ridiculous that whole plotline is. And the movie does completely lionize him. The characters refer to him as a badass. The kids are completely in love with him from the word go. Kids kind of represent the audience. It's like, fall in love with this character. He is amazing.
When they say, can we stick with you?
Yeah.
He literally hasn't done anything in front of them.
Well, he drove the truck, I think.
He drove a truck.
Backwards.
Oh, okay. Manly.
And they're like, woo!
Yeah.
He could drive a truck backwards. Let's stick with him.
Yeah, they just know that he exudes charisma and cool. They just want to be him. His character's involvement and everything, very murky. He also has this conflict with Vincent D'Onofrio about, why do you want to use these creatures for military purposes? That's his entire reason for being there.
Yeah.
It's very strange. Probably best not to dwell on it, really.
Let's not worry too much.
A lot of the connective tissue in this film is a real mess. The pace was very off. There was just sequences which just seemed in completely the wrong place. It just feels like there was 16 writers or whatever. Colin Trevorrow, the director, was brought on quite late to the process. It does feel like this quite soulless committee product, which is such a shame when, sure, the original was very financially successful. It is basically a cheesy monster horror movie, but it's done so well with so much control and heart. It's a shame the past few years when we've seen some great cheesy blockbusters, some of the Marvel films, recently Mad Max Fury Road, redefining action in the way we can use CG and practical effects. The Lego Movie, which is or should have been a soulless cash grab.
Yeah.
It's a film. It's a CGI film about a flipping toy.
Yeah.
And the Lego Movie is exciting. It's got brilliant action. It's funny. It's got character. It's witty.
Yeah. I don't think I've ever laughed so much in a movie apart from the Lego Movie.
And a much excellent. Better Chris Pratt performance. A love interest he actually has some chemistry with.
Yeah.
It's a real shame that the legacy of Jurassic Park, which we all loved as kids, has become the thing in the film that they are snarking against, this corporate beast. Maybe I made the mistake of getting my hopes up a little bit. But I think it's possible. I think we've seen some great movies, so why couldn't Jurassic Park be big and cheesy and silly, but also with that heart, also with those ideas, also with a good structure?
You don't sympathise in the characters. You don't root for any of the characters. I didn't come away from the film going, I really like that character and I really hope that
Blue was nice. The raptor.
But when you come away from a film liking a dinosaur more than you like the characters in it, you know, this is an ice age that we're watching. I don't normally get my high horse about this, but I just think that there was absolutely no role model, no strong, intelligent woman in this film. If that had changed, if there was a strong, intelligent scientist, I think that really would have added to the film.
That is a real shame when Jurassic Park has Laura Dern's character and Sam Neill's character, both really good, strong scientist characters, both aspirational, And then
yeah, and
there's nobody in Jurassic World.
Nobody whatsoever.
Well,
no.
Dr. Wu has come back from Jurassic Park, now completely evil. Yeah, yeah, yeah. For one reason, and that is to set up the sequel.
The running in heels. Why? You can't even walk across grass in stilettos.
The filmmakers are excusing this, that it was apparently Bryce Dallas Howard's idea to have Claire run in heels the whole film. Still absolutely ridiculous.
Maybe there's envy in there as well, actually. I'd love to be able to run in heels, but no.
while being chased by a T-Rex. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, the gender politics in this film feel really backwards from the start. Claire is this very uptight woman who just kind of needs to be tamed by the manly vigour of Chris Pratt. And you know, by the end, she's kind of melted. It's it just feels really retrograde. And just the fact that all the characters are dumb as posts. The characters in Jurassic Park, of course, they make mistakes. They're flawed, but mostly they make good decisions. Apart from maybe Samuel L. Jackson walk to the breaker's shed. It's not a horror film where you're shouting at the screen. Every decision in Jurassic World is stupid. So it's not chaos theory that's kind of driving the plot. It's human stupidity, which is just boring to watch. Yeah, just frustrating how much of the plot is almost Prometheus level stupidity. Not quite as bad as Prometheus. Those were scientist characters acting stupidly. And I think Bryce Dallas Howard's character, I don't think she does a bad job with it. She's absolutely fine. She's just really stuck with this awful character. I would love to see a version of this film which took her character seriously. And, you know, she's a career woman. She's competent. People respect her. She's doing her best. She's trying to spend time with her nephews. But things go wrong. I could see her being played by America Ferrera, who played Ugly Betty.
Mm.
With some warmth and personality.
The most unbelievable character for me is
Vincent D'Onofrio.
Yeah. The idea that the military would use dinosaurs. I mean, it's just ridiculous. The whole thing is ridiculous.
Hang on. He had a pet wolf when he was a kid.
But that is beyond ridiculous.
Although, again, he does a good job. He's there sort of bulging out of his tight shirt, trying to Chris Pratt. Which is not a competition anyone is going to win.
Yeah.
Disappointing death sequence. He starts giving his speech, which is clearly the I'm about to die speech, and then just gets carried off screen by a raptor. The most horrific death is kind of given to the British assistant. I kind of enjoyed that sequence.
Yeah.
It had a kind of good, like, crazy energy, almost like Gremlins kind of vibe from the evil pterodactyls.
Yes.
It didn't fit in the film. It was tonally way out of anything else. If the film had kind of mustered that level of energy and invention in some of the other sequences, maybe there was some kind of interesting satirical thing going on. As it stood, the kind of attempts at satire, we had to build this Jesse engineered dinosaur because audiences don't care about regular dinosaurs anymore. Interesting theme to explore. The film doesn't really explore it.
What I find was so ironic was when the Mosasaurus feeding show, there was a great white shark hanging there, which is an endangered species. So they have genetically modified an species that could go extinct.
Yeah, and made it twice as big as it
would
be.
Made it twice as big as it would be. And then people paid to watch it kill an endangered species. Maybe it's a metaphor for the fact that Jurassic World is going to do so much better than Jaws did in the cinema. It's literally eating Jaws.
Is there any moment the Mosasaurus jump the shark, or does it just eat it? The most disappointing thing for me is the concept that people would get bored of dinosaurs and need a genetically modified one. But, as they do say in the film, people got bored of people going to the moon, so anything is possible.
Yeah.
The public could get bored of that. I don't know if you've heard about the zoos around the country and around the world now where people are not going because they're bored of seeing elephants and monkeys.
Oh, right.
So they're genetically modifying new creatures.
Ella monkeys.
Yeah, Ella monkeys, mammoths. So before we went to see Jurassic World, the three of us had a shed outing to see Beth Shapiro.
We had a field trip.
Speak at Bristol Festival of Ideas. She was talking about how to clone a mammoth, which is her new book, which Laura's been reading.
It's all about de-extinction. So the idea of bringing species back that have previously been extinct.
It's not possible to clone dinosaurs, and that's because cloning requires a living cell, and there's never going to be a living cell for a dinosaur. There's also never going to be a living cell for anything that has been extinct for a long time. So if one really is going to resurrect a species that has been extinct, it has to A, not have been extinct for very long, B, have surviving bits of DNA, C, have a closely related genome that you might be able to use to piece together the surviving bits of DNA into an actual genome sequence, and maybe C, have the capacity to go through and use genome editing technologies to swap out bits of the thing that it's related to that's still alive with bits of the thing that you're trying to bring back.
We may not be able to clone a mammoth. However, we can take attributes of a mammoth and put them into an existing animal on this planet. So if we put them into an elephant, then an elephant could perhaps inhabit a wider area than they do just now. So they could go into like Siberia. They'd be better adapted to the cold and to the changing climate.
You're never going to be able to create something that's 100% identical to a species that is extinct or has been extinct for a long time. Because even if you could swap out every bit of the DNA in, for example, an Asian elephant genome for a mammoth genome sequence, you would still then have to use an elephant to make this thing come alive. And by virtue of developing within an elephant, being raised by elephants, etc., you would see that the gene expression, even of those mammoth-like genes, might change so that it ended up looking like an elephant. When I ask people why they are thinking of bringing any particular species back to life, the reasons vary from I really like to see that species to maybe there's some scientific reason to bring that back. To my mind, the best reasons to want to bring something back to life have to do with restoring interactions between species that might be missing because that species has gone extinct, and because reinstating those ecological interactions might then have some overall positive impact on the entire ecosystem, not just on the species that's extinct. For example, there are little things called kangaroo rats that are going extinct across the kind of desert southwest of the United States. And when they do, these guys are little environmental engineers. They burrow throughout the ground, digging up the soil. When they disappear, there's a domino effect of extinction where the birds that used to come don't anymore because there's not the same diversity of plants. The small mammals that used to come don't anymore because there are no more burrows that they can use to hide out. And replacing these guys might actually be able to restore function to that ecosystem and stop that domino effect of extinction.
Should we try and conserve the species that we've already got? Or should we be trying to bring back species that have gone extinct? So if we brought the mammoth back, you have to think of the knock-on effects. If you drop a stone in the middle of a lake and then you watch ripples come out of it. So if you go and drop a mammoth or
that's just cruel.
Place gently a mammoth or an elephant that's had adaptations. If you go and place this adapted elephant within this habitat, then the ripples on the ecosystem surrounding it, it just makes me think that the effects could be destructive to something else.
One of the most memorable images from the original Jurassic Park, and it's carried through to Jurassic World, the mosquito trapped in amber that they released the DNA from, completely rubbished by Beth Shapiro there. That just reminds you that it wasn't necessary that the science in Jurassic Park, the book or the film, was all that accurate. There was some parts of it which did relate very closely to discoveries they were making at the time, but they took a lot of liberties with the science. But the story and the way it was all structured and the kind of respect that the story had for science.
Well, as Michael Crichton said, verisimilitude is more important than veracity.
So you can genetically modify DNA. You definitely cannot bring back dinosaurs because dinosaurs went extinct approximately 65 million years ago. But there's extinct giants. The extinct giants are ancestors of today's birds. So you could make a dinosaur-like creature. So if you think about ostriches, you could go and create your own. It's like having a Lego box full of different pieces. You could create and technically create something that looks like a dinosaur today.
Yeah, you could order your own order your own dinosaur.
Yeah, exactly. I'd love a pet velociraptor.
Jesus Christ!
They're actually apparently the size of turkeys.
Yeah, but still pretty vicious.
I just want to reenact How to Train Your Dragon.
How to Train Your Velociraptor.
How to Train Your Velociraptor.
Okay.
And I want that emotional music playing in the background as I finally manage to fly my velociraptor around my turret.
I'd have a Parasaurolophus. I love Parasaurolophuses. Those heads are incredible. like have a herd of them in the garden here. Just imagine the honking sounds they'd make.
That'd be lovely.
Your neighbours would soon move out, wouldn't they? If you had a herd of them.
I reckon we could charge quite a lot for Jurassic Garden.
Yeah, get Chris Pratt round to do the barbecue.
Oh, don't even. Please send some emails. So the book How to Clone a Mammoth, The Science of De-Extinction by Beth Shapiro is fantastic so far. I'm halfway through it and it's so accessible.
The day that I met Phil Manning at Cheltenham Science Festival, that morning he...
Bragging.
No. Just such a big name.
I attached myself to these celebrities to try and make something of my life and all I get is this abuse.
Like a celebrity limpet.
Are you a crustacean or a mollusk?
Oh, come on. That morning he had been...
We're just jealous.
You're actually kind of a big deal.
The day that I met Phil Manning at Cheltenham Science Festival...
He'll remember that day.
I'm sure I read on his Twitter recently.
The day that I met Phil Manning at Cheltenham Science Festival was the day that he had been on Radio 4 that morning and lots of other things, talking about a dinosaur discovery on a beach that he'd made. And obviously, I had to ask him about that.
Yes, the sunbathing dinosaur discovery. Every dinosaur should be found on a beach because that's where is the best place to look, really. Certainly in the UK, we have this really horrible thing which a lot of people like called vegetation. And unfortunately for paleontologists, it sucks. For the simple reason, vegetation gets in the way, as does soil, for that lovely rock which contains bones of dinosaurs. So the best place to look is where the land is disappearing. And that's always happening at coastal sites because you've got coastal erosion and it exposes new finds on a regular basis. So looking for dinosaurs in the UK, beaches is the place to go. And we happened to trip over one 16 years ago in Whitby, in Yorkshire. It was close to Whitby. And we're not saying exactly where, because the cliffs are dangerous and kids, you should not go near cliffs because things will fall on your head and you die. So it's a dangerous site, but we managed to recover a large block of rock which weighed some 70 pounds, and I sort of crawled off the beach with it strapped to my back. And when we finished preparing it, it was discovered, I should say, by my good friend Alan Gurr, amazing chap, and he was spotted it as being, Phil, is this bone? I said, yes, it is bone. And when we prepared the rock away, we were able to see it was a dinosaur bone, and it was from the bottom side of the vertebrae of a sauropod dinosaur, and it's 175 million years old, and it's very precious.
Yeah. Finding a dinosaur on a beach in Yorkshire, not something you expect to happen. Probably only happens if you're a paleontologist. Or maybe it happens and you don't realise it's a dinosaur bone. But I was wondering why this particular dinosaur is so interesting.
If you can think of life on Earth through time, we have different periods where we don't know a lot because it's a rare slice of time. And that's because the right age rocks are simply not exposed at the surface that were present at the surface at that particular point in time. So when you're looking at the Middle Jurassic, you have to go to places in China or South America, usually to find rocks that were laid down in land or terrestrial environments at that point. However, the Yorkshire coast has one of these rare slivers of time, and the Saltwick Formation and the rocks above have a thin veneer of Middle Jurassic rocks in which we find the footprints of dinosaurs, but we've not ever found bones in situ. There's been bones and teeth found in the past. We're not exactly sure where they came from, certainly from the lowermost rocks. So this was the first time we had a geologist and a paleontologist together, skipping down the beach together, spotting a bone and thinking, this is important. And we're able to sort of narrow down exactly where it came. And so we've got bones associated with what we know to be the tracks of sauropod dinosaurs, long-necked, long-tailed dinosaurs, and this is a sauropod dinosaur vertebrae. And it is, in fact, the oldest of this type of dinosaur in the whole of the British Isles. So we're quite excited about that.
What sort of techniques do you use to study dinosaurs?
Well, when we first get the bone, usually we're so excited we tend to lick them, which is wrong. You shouldn't really do that, because licking bones leaves all sorts of horrible organic traces. But we do get excited. I think that there is certainly a lot of initial preparation. There's visible light we're using just to look at the morphology, the shape. But then you can start deploying much, much more applied techniques. That's where we use x-rays to maybe look through the bone to look at the relative distribution of the outer cortical bone to the more spongy trabecular bone, and that's interesting. It tells you a lot about how that bone functioned. We can then take it to somewhere like Diamond Light Source, where we can use intense X-rays generated by the synchrotron there, and synchrotron light being, of course, the brightest light in the universe, can shake the very bonds of molecules and the atoms that comprise those molecules. And we can understand, A, what the molecules comprise, what are the compounds, but more importantly, the elements which are present. And some of these elements are so crucial to life, and we can constrain and identify them in situ, in a bone, at Diamond Light Source, giving us information on this animal like we could never dream of before. So we use some quite exciting techniques now.
The podcast is about Jurassic World. Have you seen the film?
I've not seen Jurassic World, and I tell you, I watched Jurassic Park 1, and yes, it was a trouser-filling experience. It was scary. I was frightened, genuinely. I think it's wonderful. It's theatre. It's dinosaurs at their best. It's bringing out this excitement about dinosaurs. And I know a lot of people who watched that movie way back in 1995 who are now paleontologists. It inspired a lot of kids to go into this field. And even if just two or three became scientists, bargain, what a result. Even if multiple kids who were excited by the science became other disciplines in the field of science, it did a great job. Is the science correct in it? I don't really care. I think it's a film. And if a film critic starts having a go at the storyline and plots and whether or not it was a good ending in one of our papers, I'd probably thump them. And likewise, I'm not a critic, and I'm not going to start criticising a film, which I think is a good romp. It serves a very powerful purpose in engaging communities, diverse populations with science, and maybe making them look at the real science, and that's very useful.
As Phil mentioned there, Diamond Light Source is used to study dinosaur bones, and we do have a T-shirt to give away if you can answer the question earlier in the podcast about Ben's poem.
Email it to us
at thecosmicshed@soundofscience.co.uk. Because I knew I was going to speak to Phil Manning, and I asked a few people if they had any questions. And one of the questions that came in was, why did dinosaurs get so big?
Dinosaurs got big because they ate a lot. There's multiple ideas as to why dinosaurs became so large. One is that you've got an arms race. This is not dinosaurs slinging nuclear weapons at each other. No, this is where predators become bigger, and the plant eaters, which are being chewed up by the predators, the ones which are biggest tends to survive. They pass the genetic package to the next generation. So big dinosaurs, and it's this constant, when the big plant eaters are so big, it's only the big predators who get a bite, and you get this so-called arms race going on. That doesn't always work out, because it's got small dinosaurs as well. So there's other ideas to do with the physiology and the biology of these animals, in that they were much more avian, and being big and having sort of this turbocharged biology of being basically a giant bird, being able to extract so much more oxygen from the atmosphere, being so much more efficient, they could become big. And that's one of the arguments. So, and maybe there could have even been, some have suggested, elevated oxygen levels during the age of the dinosaurs. Remember, we're in a greenhouse planet, a very different world, no ice caps, for some 175 million years. So it was a sort of optimal environment for these organisms to exploit and occupy, and they did so very successfully.
So there's a theory that they basically increased in size exponentially until the ecosystem couldn't hold them anymore, they couldn't live alongside each other anymore. And then there's a great debate about whether they're exotherms or endotherms. And it's suggested that to live in that environment, they would have to be endothermic. But there's a lot of controversy around that. There's a lot of different theories around whether they're exotherms or endotherms. But to be an animal that large and to support yourself, you would automatically think you have to be an endothermic. So you'd have to maintain a constant internal body temperature. Whereas exotherms have to bask to get their energy.
So, Jurassic World, Jurassic Park, you choose.
Jurassic Universe.
Thank you very much indeed to Phil Manning, Beth Shapiro, Catherine Boast and Jim Alkalili. If you'd like to hear more from us, you can subscribe via
iTunes, Stitcher, Player FM, all your podcasting platforms.
Find us on Facebook.
Follow us on Twitter.
At The Cosmic Shed.
Or visit thecosmicshed.com.
If you'd like to support The Cosmic Shed, you can have a look at patreon.com/thecosmicshed. You can email us.
thecosmicshed@soundofscience.co.uk. We're also supported by Audible. Visit audibletrial.com/thecosmicshed where you could, he had a free trial of Audible, which is somewhere you can get audiobooks, and you could download Beth Shapiro, How to Clone a Mammoth. And thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.
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 The Cosmic Shed.
Science fact.
Science fiction.
And everything in between. As Michael Crichton says, verbalism is better than that. What is it? As Michael Crichton says, verisimilitude. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. As Michael Crichton says, sorry, it's a real sentence. Yeah, as Michael Crichton said, verisimilitude is more important than veracity. If you're still listening, well done. We've got a little hidden track for you here, which is Andy Day came to visit the shed. He sat in the shed. He and I had a cup of tea and a chat, and we found it impossible to edit, really. It was really exciting for me to have Andy come to the house. Really exciting for Lyra, my daughter, to have Andy come to the house. Andy Day is a children's television presenter. He presents CBeebies, and he also has his own programmes on CBeebies, two of which are Andy's Wild Adventures and Andy's Dinosaur Adventures, in which he and Hattie work in the Dinosaur Gallery at the National Museum.
Frequently, myself or Hattie do something which causes a kerfuffle in the dinosaur section of the National Museum, and then it has to be fixed in literally minutes, because we have people coming, kids coming in to come and view the exhibition. And I always say, don't worry, I'll sort it out. She always just leaves it to me. And she's right to leave it to me, because I am able to go back in time, my time machine, which is a grandfather clock, go back in time, visit the dinosaurs and go and get what I need, whether it be sand dollar or dinosaur egg shells or anything.
That must be very useful, having a clock that can take you back in time.
So useful. Can't make any mistakes because I just correct them.
That's
true. If I say anything I don't want to say, I don't even have to edit it. I'll come back.
Okay.
And I'll just say it again.
Oh, that's what just happened. I thought that was a glitch in the Matrix, but that was actually just you coming back to correct that.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Bit of deja vu. Yeah.
And does anyone else in the museum know about the clock?
No, it's just me.
Right.
It's actually just me, which I think is good, because it's just me and the kids that go on the journey.
Yeah.
Which is, we discussed it actually when we were talking about ideas for it. Should I be the only one to know? Should Hattie know and maybe come on the adventure with me? But no, it kind of takes it out of the realm of possibility. But you know, it's almost possible that I know if everyone. Yeah. You know what I mean?
No, okay.
It makes it a bit more dangerous.
I have a question from Jenny, and it is Andy in the programme?
Yes.
In love with Hattie.
Where did this go? Because there's quite a few people that, well, kids actually. That, well, no, it must have been adults, because there's been people tweeting about it, and it wouldn't be the children, but it must be from the kids asking maybe. Mm. She's not my love interest.
Okay.
Although I do think on CBeebies there should be love interests. Yeah. I think that it should be introduced.
Okay.
Not, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, not
in a
like
child-friendly way.
Yeah, not too far.
Yeah.
Speaking about child-friendliness, there's Dinosaur Adventures, there's Wild Adventures, there's TikTok Time Machine. There's kind of, I don't know if you've noticed, there's kind of a sciencey thing going on.
Well, I tell you what it is, Andy. I'm like a big kid. Mm. When I was younger, my favourite film, and still is, was Back to the Future.
Okay.
My current favourite film is still The Matrix. Okay. You know, stuff like that. It's just, it's the realm of impossibility now, but you just never know. I don't know. It's always, it's potential, isn't it? It's always potential. And it's fantasy and it's imagination and it's, you know, what would you do if you could go back in time? And and it's adventure, you know, and that's what I love. Right. I love all that. It's got to come from something that I love doing as well, I think. I think that always helps. It's like having a passion for something and then someone else is inspired by it. But it is something that I think everyone's interested in. Dinosaurs, time machine, adventure, the what ifs. It's just fun.
Yeah.
It's just fun. Yeah. You know, you don't, there's no boundaries with it. And I like that. I like that there's no limits.
You know, I like dinosaurs. I like science. But I would never have known about Andy's dinosaur adventures and the other things
if it wasn't for Lyra.
I imagine lots of people who are listening to the podcast won't know about it.
Yeah.
I'm going to say this. You don't have to agree.
Cool.
I think that it's perfectly acceptable for a grown-up to watch it without a child.
I completely agree, and actually it was made for that purpose as well. It was made with that in mind. I'm a big advocate, and so is John Miller, who directed it, and the guys who wrote it as well, and just everyone at NHU, Natural History Unit, who got involved in it. I think, and it's, I don't know if you... Did you see TikTok Time Machine? Have you seen it? Like,
no,
oh, it's a shame, because you'd have enjoyed it. It had lots of references for the adults. And I think whatever I do, I always think you shouldn't segregate children from adults. There's just different levels. There isn't a kind of... There's one for one and one for the other. We're all kind of big kids, really, and we can all relate to being a child. So there's nothing wrong with taking advantage of that and creating something that's on different levels. So you can see it on one level, and there's a little bit of tongue-in-cheek for the adults, and the kids will get the another level of it, whether it be, you know, the colours, or whether it be the idea of going back in time, or, you know, because kids don't really understand
time.
Yeah. You know, it's quite a difficult one, really, or how far back in time you can go. Like, they don't really understand that.
Yeah.
But of course, parents do, and, you know, there's lots to play with, and I just don't ever think you should just make it for one, especially with CBeebies. And as a parent, I'm sure you will agree that you know, you have to sit down in front of it, and you want to as well with Lyra, to understand what she's watching, and to make sure that she's watching safe and educational and fun programme.
Absolutely, yeah. And thank you for making it in that way, because it's been brilliant watching that. You know, we watch them over and over again, because that's what kids want to do.
Yeah, yeah, of course. And so you're sick of them.
No, I'm not. Yeah. I'm genuinely not. I mean, this is a question from Eli Taylor, who's 5. What's your favourite place that you've had an adventure?
For wild adventures, I would have to say the Japanese macaques, because I got to go in a hot spring and hang out with the macaques. That was fun. Also, when I hid underneath the emperor penguin and shrunk down, that was also fun. I had lots of fun in the lemur episode when I was bouncing around on Kip's invention. And for the dinosaurs, pretty much every dinosaur adventure I go on, I really enjoy.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah.
They must be quite scary at times, though.
Yeah, but, you know, I've always got Hattie's backpack.
I was wondering, actually, do you have a favourite gizmo that you've used in the 2 series?
Yeah, well, I mean, the gizmo itself is pretty cool.
Yeah. Is it the same one in Wild Adventures and...
Slightly modified.
Right.
Yeah, it does slightly different things. I can't shrink down in the dinosaur when I grow, but in the new... Oh, I said too much. the new set of dinosaur programs that might be happening... they will have a big, more to do with the gizmo. There'll be more things I can use the gizmo for.
Cool.
And I think that's good, because the gizmo is great fun.
I don't suppose there was much call for you shrinking down for the dinosaurs. Maybe.
No, because they're so big.
Yeah.
You know, and even the small ones that, you know, no smaller than, say, a chicken.
Yeah.
So
you've just said more. Come on. There's more dinosaur adventures.
Well, I mean, it's not been greenlit, but it is happening. And there's slightly different adventures. There's more adventures as well. Maybe some new faces.
Uh-huh.
Maybe. Nothing's been confirmed yet.
Okay. So it's not going to be Andy and Mr. Bloom's dinosaur adventures, is it?
No, I wish it would, because I love Mr. Bloom.
Yeah. That would be nice.
Start a different kind of ecosystem when we go back in time.
Yeah. I'm not sure it'd be that useful, actually, thinking about it.
The veggies would just be eaten by, you know, Diplodocus and all the...
Does the museum clock only take you back in time to when dinosaurs ruled the world?
Ah, well, the museum clock has only taken me back in time to when dinosaurs ruled the world, but it may take me to different places this time. Oh. But it is always back in time. It's not.
It can't go forward.
It can't go forward in time.
Yeah, no, I think that's
wise.
Yes, I think it's definitely wise. But if you could go anywhere in time in your museum clock, where would you go?
I'd go back to the 80s.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What?
And I'd go back to the obviously just go and hang out with the dinosaurs again.
Yeah. But what happened in the 80s that you want to?
It's just good. I like the music.
Okay.
Yeah, and the good films.
Okay.
I mean, cheesy.
Yeah.
You know.
What sort of thing? Film wise,
classic 80s. You know, the Goonies.
Oh yeah.
Back to the Future.
Yeah.
Favorite film there, like I said. Absolutely. Go and get the almanac. Yeah, I'd probably do that. 1950s, okay. 2000s.
Right. Is there a kind of soundtrack to your trip?
Yeah, it has to be Huey Lewis.
Oh yeah. Jurassic Park, is that one that you...
Yes, I've seen the trailer and I'm looking forward to seeing it because I remember going to see it, Jurassic Park, when I was 12, would have been 11 or 12, at the cinema. I'm giving you a tip on my age now. although, according to Wikipedia, I'm 40 years old, which isn't the truth. I watched it with my dad and my two brothers and it was like the best film I'd ever seen at that point, so it was brilliant. And then there was like the 2 and 3, and you kind of like, oh, I'm a bit over this. And then I think there was even a 4th, wasn't there? No, this is the 4th. Yes, I'm really looking forward to it because technology has moved on, and you'd hope that the script would be really, really good.
You would hope, wouldn't you?
And there's been enough of a gap.